London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today, London Column is devoted entirely to the voices of two British statesmen, of Mr. Attlee, the Prime Minister, speaking on Britain's civil defence, and of Mr. Churchill, recently the recipient of high honour in Denmark. Mr. Winston Churchill, accompanied by Mrs. Churchill, has lately paid an official visit to Denmark, whose king, whose government, whose learned men and whose people wish to shower affection and honour upon one of the great men of our age. A personal guest of the King and Queen of Denmark, Mr. Churchill was welcomed by the biggest crowd Copenhagen has ever seen. He addressed thousands gathered in Copenhagen's largest hall. He received from Copenhagen University an honorary doctorate of philosophy. A state banquet was given in his honour. We think you would like to hear extracts from his speeches. Here, firstly, then, is Mr. Churchill's reply at Copenhagen University.
As life unfolds, I've been astonished to find how many more degrees I have received than examinations which I have passed. I was never very good at those. But now I am treated as if I were quite a learned man. This, I think, is a good argument for not being discouraged by the failures or shortcomings of youth, but to persevere and go on trying to learn all your life.
Mr. Churchill, having added that he didn't have the advantage of a university education himself, nevertheless had definite views on the part that a university must play in opening the doors of human thought and development.
The first duty of a university is to teach wisdom, not a trade. To confirm character and not impart technicality. We want a lot of engineers in the modern world, but we do not want a world of engineers. We want some scientists, but we must make sure that science is our servant and not our master. It may well be that the human race has already found out more than its present imperfect and incomplete stature will enable it to digest. No amount of technical knowledge can replace the comprehension of the humanities or the study of history and philosophy.
And at the state banquet in his honor, Mr. Churchill spoke with fervor for the preservation of the Western way of life, of European civilization itself. Once again, here was Winston Churchill, the protagonist of European unity.
A young English writer has said that the real demarcation between Europe and Asia is no chain of mountains, no natural frontier, but a system of beliefs and ideas which we call Western civilization. In the rich pattern of this culture, he said, there are many strands. The Hebrew belief in God, the Christian message of compassion and redemption, the Greek love of truth, beauty, and goodness, Roman genius, the law, all these are involved in the idea of Europe. Europe is a spiritual conception, but if men cease to hold that conception, cease to feel its worth in their hearts, it will die. Now these are words which express my faith. These are words which I trust will express yours. We should proclaim our resolve that the spiritual conception of Europe shall not die. We should declare, on the contrary, that it shall live and shine and cast a redeeming illumination upon a world of confusion and woe. We hope to reach again a Europe purged of the slavery of ancient and classical times, in which men will be as proud to say, I am a European, that once they were to say, Cives Romanus sum. We hope to see a Europe where men of every country will think as much of being a European as of belonging to their own native land. And wherever they go in this wide domain, they will feel that they can truly say that I am at home. Peoples of Europe, I have certainly not added to their dangers by proclaiming, as they have through the Council of Europe and through the Atlantic Pact, their resolve to fight together and, if need be, to die together in defense of the freedom which is their joint treasure.
Like yourselves, we in Britain are alive to the imperative need for building up our civil defense, a field of service in which we need no long memories to tell us what it's all about. Britain, like yourselves, must have all the volunteers she can to man the fire services, the hospitals, police, the warden and rescue squads. And the urgency of the matter recently brought to the microphone the most senior member of our government. And in a nationwide broadcast, Mr. Attlee, the Prime Minister, reminded us that the technique of aerial warfare has changed a great deal since the last war.
We have the experience of the last war to guide us. How did we defeat the Blitz in the last war? By the skill, devotion, courage and self-sacrifice of thousands of ordinary citizens, men and women. It could not have been done simply by the action of professional forces. It was done by the efforts of the whole community, by an unexampled display of neighborliness on the part of the whole community without distinction. But these efforts were coordinated by the government and local authorities. They were directed in each locality by men and women who had learnt their job. Throughout the country, in every town and village, were men and women who knew what to do when trouble arose, whether it was dealing with incendiaries or fighting fire, rescue work or hospital service, first aid or the care of the homeless, or any of the other jobs of civil defense. If war should ever come again, which God forbid, we must be ready. We must do our utmost to prevent war reaching these shores. But should it do so, we must be prepared to meet it with the same spirit and the same skill that was shown in the last war.
And this week, our first script with strongly biographical flavor comes from guest London columnist Lionel Gamlin. Lionel?
Thank you. Only the day before yesterday, a stalwart character to whom politics is avowedly a closed book and deliberately closed at that, startled some of us at lunch by saying, in my view, Britain has only produced two great prime ministers in this century, Winston Churchill and Clement Attlee. Does that surprise you also, just a little? I was shaken for a moment, I must admit, but after a bit, you know, I began to see what my friend was driving at. The road to greatness isn't always the one that's floodlit, perhaps. And history may yet reveal that the two British prime ministers, whose names have been most familiar on both sides of the Atlantic in recent years, are not in fact quite so different in character as popular legend, or shall we say popular journalism, have led us to believe. Now, at the risk of crossing the 38th platitude, let me remind you of the old saying that the child is father to the man. And so let me also acquaint you with one or two facts about the childhood of Mr. Churchill and Mr. Attlee, which I think you may not know, and which is certainly well worth recalling. Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill made a typical entry into this world 2 months early, to be precise. Now, if that wasn't the clearest sign of the man of action in the making, what was? From the very beginning, too, his sympathies were transatlantic. The grandson of an English duke and of an American newspaper man, Leonard Jerome, proprietor and editor of the New York Times. And by the way, how delighted the founder of the two first American race courses, Jerome Park and Coney Island Jockey Club, would have been last week to see his cherubic 75-year young grandson win a famous English horse race on his way to a great political party conference. And that only a few hours after flying back from Denmark, where, as you've heard, he'd just collected yet another honorary degree to flout the memory of early scholastic failures. Incidentally, how stupid the late Adolf Hitler was to imagine that he could cow that Englishman of whom it has been said, at the tender age of 7 by his dancing mistress, that he was the naughtiest small boy in the world. School days, indeed, were not the happiest days of Master Churchill's life. As you know, he never rose above the junior school at Harrow, and he hated the tyranny of books and compulsory games from first to last. Well, now, what of Clement Richard Attlee's childhood? Well, he was one of a large, upper-middle-class family, and his was a contented, unspectacular path from the beginning. Small and shy, and peculiarly self-conscious, Clement Richard would blush at the slightest pretext. Before he went off to boarding school, he was taught by that same governess who'd previously wrestled with the son of Lord Randolph Churchill. But although she declared that Master Winston had proved extremely strong-willed, it seems that she had nothing to declare about Master Clement. So he was clearly not the naughtiest small boy in the world. And yet, you know, he too shared young Winston's dislike of the prevailing worship of games in English schools. And he also shared a liking for one game not usually worshipped or compelled here, the game of polo. Though in his case, it was played not on ponies, but in the Attlee front garden, on bicycles. The front lawn, Mr. Attlee has recalled, large and intersected with flower beds, formed an excellent field of play, and all sorts of local rules were invented. And I dare say all sorts of carefully planted flowers were cut off in their prime. Now, was it perhaps this common bond of juvenile delinquency that years later enabled these two Englishmen, so outwardly different, to work so harmoniously together in the days of World War II? Or was it, I wonder, that behind the scenes, away from the limelight, Clement Richard Attlee had a quiet sense of humour very much in common with his public rival's sense of humour? Several of my family were millers, the Prime Minister told an audience at a baker's lunch a year or two back. They did fairly well till Mr. Rank came along. But that, of course, is before the jolly Miller Rank went into British movies. Well, there, my friends, I must say goodbye. Yes, boys will be boys, they say. But I, for one, maintain that old boys have more in common than we youngsters realize, even if they do warm their backsides on different sides of the political fireplace. Goodbye.
Thank you, Lionel. And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a radio digest produced each week by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. Was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.